about that, she reminded herself. It all came to her in an instant, her thoughts happening at the same time Nemo was being torn apart. It seemed to last a long time and she could hear every tweak of it. She would never forget that sound. They could all hear it. They looked up as if they could see through to the other side. Then all went silent, except her pounding heart. "What now?" breathed Johns. "Quiet, shush, Masters." He was listening. Jane watched him intently. Her breath was shallow. What was Masters listening for? What was he thinking? Was there something he could do? She couldn't take her eyes off him. She wanted to see it there in his eyes right now, "We're fine." But she didn't see that. It was something else she saw, fear. All Masters thought was that he had to do something. Nemo could tangle up in the wreck, she could get caught in the lines if the rigging was involved. Masters threw a look to Jade as he peered at the port window, hoping to see the problem, or more so a way out of this. There was nothing. His heart had an irregular beat. He turned the camera and tried to use it to see the predicament. But there wasn't anything he could see, and there wasn't any time to wait. "Damn it," Masters said. All too aware of the danger, not only of badly damaging Titanic's remains, but even worse, of destroying Nemo, his mind jumped into survival mode. Masters grabbed the radio. Flynn was his only hope. He had to trust him. "Flynn, come around," cringed Masters. "We hit something." Luckily, Flynn, as he closed in, could see it. "Okay, okay. Wait. You're right under a pipe." "Copy." "We scraped it. I heard it run along the top," Masters said. "Shit, we heard scraping all right," Johns blurted out. "The damn." "Quiet," Masters ordered. He turned back to the radio. "What can you see?" "Give me details," said Masters. Then Flynn angled his light in hopes to see well enough to figure how to get them out. "It is not good." The pipe was from the rigging or the crane. It was hard to tell. Pieces were where they landed. It didn't matter now. It wasn't a pipe that should have been there, but everything was out of place. Was Nemo damaged? That was what Master's shaken heart shot to his brain. There was no telling what the scraping pipe had caused or what to do about it. All Masters knew is that he wanted to see it, to survey the damage. Then he could judge what to do. He was blind, relying on Flynn, and that didn't sit well. "Are you seeing leaks?" Masters looked in fear. They listened and drew out flashlights to thoroughly check the corners. Everybody's heart was pounding. They were struck hard enough by the rogue piping, the implosion now inflicting on this last precious moment of life, cut short by scientific wonders mingling between decades. "These are the risks you take," Masters thought. "Atlantic Siren, Master Control, we got a situation," he said. The fright made Jade's lungs tight, claustrophobic. Why was she not able to stop her lungs from doing that? Her breath became shallow, fear did that to her. As her fear worsened, her lungs tightened. She forgot to breathe. Panic was setting in. Her hands were sweating. That always happened to her when she was scared. In Nautilus, Flynn turned to Danny. "Shit. Do we risk exceeding 2 meter speed?" Mac didn't know what that meant. But it didn't sound good. It meant they were risking crashing into Titanic themselves. The dive process profile was compromised. Danny pushed the vertical thrusters, hoping to make a cautious sweeping turn to approach. Flynn couldn't see much, but he turned Neptune, bringing her tight. He could see Nemo. "I'm bringing out Neptune. I need some light. Hang tight." Flynn pushed a button at the controls and released Neptune. Danny angled Neptune and then used the camera to see how badly off Nemo was. "You gotta come down," he confirmed. Dudley's voice came from the radio. "Surface control to Nemo. Report." Masters didn't have time to answer. Mac was petrified. His camera rolled instinctively. "What the hell is going on?" he thought. "It was fine 1 minute ago, it was all fine." Now a tightness hit his stomach, right in the pit. He just thought of Jade. It was hard to sit and see the whole thing play out on the screen knowing Jade wasn't there. How he wished they hadn't come, but then people always say that when an adventure goes wrong. He wanted to wring Master's neck. He wanted someone to blame, but he just kept his eyes staring at the porthole and then to the screen. Jade's sweaty hands slid down the window as she tried to get a look. She wanted to help. She wasn't filming now, her hands were too shaky. It was a fear she had never felt before. Her flashlight fell on Master's face. He wanted to console her but only turned his eyes from the annoying light she shone on him. Johns was too preoccupied with himself, too lost in his own thoughts to notice. In Nautilus, Mac forced an answer. "What are you going to do?" There was terror in his voice. Flynn was in shock. He had prepared for this but only in practice. "Fuck," he thought. "Look, she's got a pipe about to go up her ass. If you back her out, you'll tear the shit out of her," Danny insisted. "Can't you tilt her down, bring the bow down and then," Mac said as he drew close to the screen. "Shut up. Let me think," Flynn flared up. "Fucking do something. Hurry." Mac was freaking. "Give me something." Masters hurried. "You got to bring her down," Mac was sure. Flynn turned on him. "You don't know shit about these crafts, so shut up. If you don't tilt her down, she'll ram that pipe." "You can't risk that." Mac's adrenaline was at peak. "God damn it. I need to clear." Masters was out of time. Mac grabbed the microphone. "You got a two-pipe situation here," said Mac. "The ripping you heard was the pipe bringing the other pipe along the wheelhouse." Flynn grabbed the mic. "It's two pipes. The scraping noise was you moving her." "Well, that's my guess," Flynn surmised. "That's good. That's great," breathed Masters. "The pipe's bent, locking you in. You gotta go forward and drop. Slink forward. You got to move some water in your ballast tanks." Flynn knew the danger. It ran through Master's head that doing this decreased his chances of making it to the top, if they ever made it out of the scrape. He hesitated as he moved his hand to make the adjustment. He had to trust Flynn. "Nemo, move it down as the ballast field. Tilt your port side," Flynn decided. "I'm talking gentle." "Forward port side tilt," Masters confirmed. His whiskers tightened on his skin as his face clinched the blood vessels of his square jaw. "What the hell is going on?" Dudley's voice scratched over the radio. There was no time to answer. Johns had slightly moved the bow forward and tilted down. But could he make it past the pipe? He was good, but just how good? Masters would find out. The pipes were less than an inch off, as Johns tilted down and away. Fucking careful, man. Okay. Now go down. Bring her down, gently, directed Flynn. Have I got it? Asked Johns. Yeah. Now come on down, like, a foot. You got it clear. Just a foot, continued Flynn. Come on down, John's voice was full of dread. He lightly touched the controls, trying his utmost to put Nemo out of this dire moment. He was showing just how good he was. He had the touch. Okay, stop, stop. Okay, Flynn was watching. His eyes locked on the screen of Neptune's camera view. Back out straight, now. Copy, Flynn hurried. Back up, Masters repeated. Roger. Reversing out, said Johns. Nemo moved. They listened for any screech that meant implosion. Am I clear? Am I clear? Johns gasped. Yeah, clear. All clear, Flynn breathed out. The stern dipped and they scraped by. Danny and Mac were getting it all on film. Dudley, sweating, up topside, could only listen. Jade, Johns and Masters sat in silence, looking at each other, contemplating what might have been. Jade's lungs filled with a breath automatically. It was good the body worked that way, because she was not able to think about air. The shallow breaths she had taken had hardly done the job. She was pale. Anyone in her shoes would have felt the same. Eye to eye with Jade, Masters had a moment that he had not wanted. He couldn't let her look at him this way, for she would see his affection. His heart was beating fast as he turned. Glad she was alive, his hand wanted to reach out and let her know all was safe, she was safe with him, but how could he ever hope to say that? He was here in the depths of the sea on a mission that had its trials. He needed a stiff drink. The moment passed none too soon as he looked out at Titanic. He slipped back into his hard shell. Bringing Sinbad around, he said. Sinbad was on his mind now. He brought her around. Then he deftly steered the bot out onto the deck of Titanic. Sinbad had the same piercing, green eyes for headlights, as the Nemo and Neptune twins, but on a much smaller scale. Sinbad is leashed. She's out for a walk, Masters confirmed. Sinbad and Neptune met up outside Titanic's massive upper deck just past Titanic's boiler casing funnel. Then they passed the Marconi radio room. The bots were skillfully driven to the waiting dark interior of Titanic, their green lights shooting out rays to the ghostly dark deck below. Danny, we're going down the grand staircase, said Masters. Copy, Danny answered. We're on the interior bow run, grand staircase. Copy, Masters was back on track. What the hell do I record? What just happened? Copy, ranted Dudley. But Johns was shocked at what he saw. The whole deck collapsed, said Johns, disenchanted at Sinbad's camera view, as they passed down the destroyed staircase and the crumbling A and B decks. Would they still be able to get into Astor's suite? What was all this risk for? Thought Johns. Masters slipped into the past as Sinbad's shots played on the screen. He envisioned the domed ceiling that had once so beautifully covered the grand staircase. It was the defining mark of the White Star Line, a staircase that had spread 19 feet across and 26 feet long. It was built so that when the sun came through the dome, the whole staircase was lit like a shining jewel. The first class passengers would have been impressed as they entered, which was Morgan's idea. This was the last of the decadent period when notoriety came with one's status. When one of these couples stood at the top of the staircase, it was as if they had arrived for a gala ball. They entered, were announced, and then floated down the stairs. This ship gave them the chance to flaunt wealth, and gave the women the excuse to dress with every change of jewelry, for every occasion. They wore the jewels to be noticed, and noticed they were, as they entered through this, the epitome of elegant nautical architecture of its day. As Sinbad came down the staircase, the camera captured the room. Master's heart was full of the romantic notions that he held in his mind of this early period of history. Sometimes he felt he was born in the wrong century. He grabbed the controls of Sinbad and moved her towards the exquisite teak walls. The design of the woodwork could still be seen in detail. Masters drove Sinbad and caught sight of the fireplace. He was ecstatic. These would be the images that would drive the masses to flock to the virtual tour. "Bring Neptune around, give me some side light on the fireplace," asked Masters. In the corner he could make out something. He turned Sinbad towards it. "There, right there. It's the piano." "Nice," said Flynn. Most of the beautiful interior was covered in sandy powder. As Sinbad went along, it bumped into the rusticles hanging off the ceiling. Part of the chandelier was visible. Its stunning crystal bobs reflected in Sinbad's light as it held at a crooked angle by its chain. The sofas were eaten, but the frames were there, and the grand clock and teak frame windows were still intact. The leaded glass was still beautiful. "What an era," he thought. Masters only imagined the conversations that went on in the first class entrance and lounge. This ship was carrying passengers that were wealthy beyond the meaning of the word. They lingered in the style they expected to be pampered in. To be seen with their servants, their furs and their jewelry, that was the enjoyment. The difference between first class and third class status would be extreme. Morgan himself was supposed to be on this ship, he thought. Masters maneuvered Sinbad deeper into the bowels of Titanic, to B-deck. Some of the deck around the staircase had slumped down as if it had melted. It was difficult to discern exactly where they were at any given time. On the monitor, Jane watched as Masters simulated, with graphics, exactly where the Ravs were within the labyrinth interior of Titanic. The graphic map of how it would have looked originally gave Masters a great sense of just where they were. Neptune followed on, shining her eerie green light down the cavernous staircase. Rusticles covered much of the sleek trim walls and passageways inside Titanic's vast body. There was still some reminiscence of the grand shape and the original design the way the stairs graced the perimeter of the entrance. "B deck? Is this B deck?" asked Johns. "This would be B deck and C deck mingling with E deck." "I'm seeing deck collapse here," said Danny. "Copy that. It's C deck." "Move on in," said Masters. "Right behind you." "Over," said Danny. Masters then maneuvered Sinbad down into what had been the corridor, or what was left of it. In this strange dark orientation, covered in sea rust, what it should have looked like and what it looked like now were night and day. "This is the port side of Seed Deck," Masters reminisced. "Okay, head up and we'll come in another way." They angled the bots to the next hole. Heading to Astor's parlor suite, Masters was engrossed. "Look at that, there is the wood paneling. It's beautiful. Still intact." They came to a broken window. They sent the bots in. "Sinbad is clear." Neptune went in. Flynn cringed as the tether passed the window's jagged edge, as Danny drove Neptune into Astor's suite. I'm on C-Deck in John Astor's suite. Look at that. Look at that. Are you getting this? Right behind you, said Danny. The suites have the most beautiful finish. Astor, he had his own sitting room, two wardrobe rooms and a private bath and a lavatory, said Masters. As the most expensive accommodations on Titanic, the wealthy would have expected nothing less than the best. The woodwork revealed how intricate the handcrafted, detailed overlay with beveled design was, against the inlaid, leaded glass. Jade was mesmerized. I'm getting reflection. Bounce your light there, right there. Yeah, perfect, said Masters. Then the clear image of well-lit footage came on the screen. The light from Sinbad and Neptune shone in tandem on this Irish craftsmanship, but it mattered little to the microorganisms that were eating away at it. I can see through the window into the suite. There's a top hat just sitting there on the dresser. It's still intact, said Masters. Zoom in. Jade was so drawn into this world. The elegance, the size and the money these people threw around. Astor was loaded. This was, what, how much, for a one-way ticket, John said. If you have to ask, you can't afford it, Astor's replied. The interior window to the private first-class deck was broken. Astor's decided to go out there. Bring him on out, said Masters. The bots crept through the window. Okay. We're on Astor's private promenade deck, enthused Masters. Astor. What the hell, man? He'd sit right there, boss, having coffee, counting his wad of cash. He was found with like $10,000 still in his vest pocket. John's boasted. This is where they had breakfast. Look at that. Masters was in awe. Man, the parlor suites were the ticket, said Johns. Okay. We're good here. Move out, Masters ordered. Neptune went first, and then Sinbad, but the tether got cut as Sinbad slid through the wreck. It was a risky way to exit, but there wasn't much choice. Floating loose, there was no way to grab Sinbad. Fuck, there goes a $500,000, said Johns. Damn it, Masters said under his breath. What the fuck, boss? She'll be down here forever, Johns harped. Okay, Flynn, get Neptune over, Masters focused. Sinbad is just floating off there on the parlor deck. If they don't think of something, she will float away. I'm not losing her, Astor's determined. Jade watched the screen as Sinbad's camera, a man, was still shooting as it bumped into the rust diggles in the room. Rust powder fell everywhere as it Sinbad took off on her own. Strange angles of the ceiling came up on the monitor as Sinbad shot where she pleased. Extreme close-ups of the rusticles appeared on the monitor as she banged into them. The tether was only designed for power, not for the nasty slice that cut the cable. Astor's heart sank as Sinbad was unleashed, its light pointing where the current took it. Get Neptune over there. See if you can push Sinbad this way, urged Masters. We're gonna come around on the deck and see if we can get her off the ceiling, and then catch her, hurried Masters. You're gonna push her to the bot door. Neptune bumped Sinbad and pushed it toward the door. See if I can open the door with the arms, said Masters. Nemo came around to the other side. Masters pulled out the mechanical arms. Nemo pushed the wooden door. Rusticles turned into powder as they broke, blocking the view for a moment, but it didn't do damage to Titanic itself. Easy, Masters urged Johns. Again the push, and it opened, releasing a ton of rusticles breaking off into powdery smoke. The door stayed intact on its hinges. The powder was blocking the view they all waited to see. "Where the hell is Sinbad?" Masters gasped. As it cleared, there was Sinbad bobbing around. But it was generally floating up. "Can you get on top? Push her down?" asked Masters. "Shit. She's gonna get stuck on the ceiling," John said. They all watched as it bumped into rusticles, leaving a powder trail as it escaped up and out of their reach. "Get up there, come on," said Masters. His nerves were on edge. Danny maneuvered Neptune on top of Sinbad. Flynn, Mac and Danny could see from Neptune's camera that Sinbad was stuck in a beam. Danny used smooth action to aim Neptune and push Sinbad toward Nemo and then finally brought it back down. "Grab her with the arms," ordered Masters. "Copy," said Flynn. "Get Nautilus over here." "Real close," said Masters. Flynn moved in so they were both there close, knocking the bot about with the mechanical arms as it floated between them. It was like playing a game with a $500,000 ball that you couldn't catch. "It just spins," Flynn quivered. "I can't grab it," said Danny, defeated. "Push it this way," said Masters as he frantically watched it float away. "Shit," Johns complained. "Come on." "Damn it," Danny tried again and missed. "Keep calm, try again."
"You have to," Masters said.
Danny tried again. Sinbad only went where wanted. It followed the drift of the ocean's sway. Free in the current, it was still getting shots all the while, of the interior full of sea debris, forever to join Titanic with its short-lived existence here on the floor of sea deck. "We've got to work together," Masters urged Flynn. All this chat over the radio and still Sinbad bobbed toward the ceiling on sea deck. It would be the most expensive piece of equipment on Titanic. A little updated, but just as far below the sea as the ship itself, thought Masters. He couldn't afford that. He had to get her out. "How the hell? We got to grab it." He turned to Johns. "Johns. Open the bot doors," he said. "Danny, push it to me, come on, right to me. I'm going to catch it. This has to work," he said. As Sinbad got close to the door, Masters stretched out Nemo's arms as far as they could and grabbed for Sinbad. "Shit," Masters said, as he missed. He maneuvered the mechanical arm for another try. This would be the end of his hopes to secure his video tour. He was so close, all the time and effort and funding, and now this. He just needed to grab it. It was so close, yet so far. There was little he could do. He placed his hand back on the controls of the mechanical arms. "Give it a push down when I say," Masters had hoped. Danny brought up Neptune and was ready for Masters' command. "Okay, now," said Masters. The bot floated down to the waiting arms that grabbed at it, but it slipped as it had nothing to grab onto. The arms just knocked Sinbad and swung her around in a slight spin away from Nemo. This time Masters had the hang of it. He grabbed the handles of the arms like some slick kid at the controls of a video game. The arms moved out. Masters eyed the timing. He stretched them wide, and as Sinbad came in range, Masters tightened the grip on his hand and the arms moved. But Sinbad escaped. "Damn. I was never good at this sort of shit," Danny snarled. "Try again. Push her down. Push her to me," said Masters.
Danny pushed Sinbad with Neptune while Flynn used the arms of Nautilus to keep Sinbad moving toward Nemo. Masters put out Nemo's arms. Danny kept nudging Sinbad and kept it moving in toward Nemo. At the exact moment, Masters drew the arms together round the floating body and entwined Sinbad like a baby in its mother's arms, not able to get away. Master's stomach was tight.
"You got it, you got it," sighed Flynn.
Masters was on the edge of his nerves. It wasn't yet over. "Now see if I can get her in the bot door," said Masters. Masters brought the arms into the most closed position. His stomach was in knots. Flynn used the mechanical arms of Nautilus to push and angle Sinbad. And with his adept touch to the controls, he somehow got Sinbad into the bot cage. Nautilus took her arms back and then maneuvered Neptune. Suddenly, the lights in Nemo went dim and flickered off, then back on again.
"What's wrong?" asked Jade, scared.
"Shit. Shit," said Johns.
"Nautilus, we've lost power."
"Over,"
Masters urgently said into the intercom. Some interior lights dimly flashed.
"Can they hear us?" said Johns, his voice cracking in fear too.
"Nautilus, can you hear me?" Masters was urgent.
"Nemo, can you hear me?"
"Over," said Danny, urgently.
"What the hell?" Johns didn't believe it.
"Hang tight a moment."
"Over," Danny told him.
"Do you have a visual on us?"
"Nautilus."
"Keep talking."
"Nautilus.
Come in."
Switch to O power. Johns grabbed the light.
"Nautilus, can you hear me?"
"Over."
Masters was frantic.
"Come on."
Johns feared. Jade had had enough excitement. She wanted out. Her face was pale. She kept on filming, the camera running even though it was dark. Her finger felt the camera body for the spotlight. She didn't hold it up to her eye, but it was getting all the action and the whole dialogue while the lights were going off and on. John's eyes looking terrified as he ran the controls. Even Masters looked thrashed. The camera didn't care. It just trolled and recorded. In Nautilus, they wondered why Nemo was offline.
"Nemo, come in.
Come in," Danny shouted into the intercom mic. Nemo was having its problems.
Masters turned on the flashlight and waited desperately for the auxiliary power switch. The light flashed around the small cabin. John's face did not look reassuring. Jade was just trying to hold it together, pretending to film as her camera rolled. Masters could tell she was terrified. Her heart was skipping beats about now.
"Turn off everything?
Bring up the circuits one by one.
Keep it on the battery." He was close to desperate himself now.
"Come in, Nautilus.
Come in.
Can you hear us, Atlantic Siren? Can you hear?"
"Copy, we're in a situation."
Masters kept on the radio.
"What's going on?"
Masters asked.
Johns looked around. He couldn't figure. He was starting to lose it too. His breath got shallow and came in short bursts, meaning he was on the verge of panicking. Then suddenly the lights flickered on again, and with the push of some buttons, Johns brought Nemo back. Masters, Jade, and Johns all breathed a collective sigh of relief as Nemo burst back into life and the lights came back on fully.
"We're up," said Masters at the radio. "I'm bringing Sinbad home.
Bring Neptune on in."
"Copy."
Chapter 23. Atlantic Siren, 1993.
Atlantic Siren rocked gently over her anchor as Jane lingered on the deck to watch the night sky. She had been through hell. The dark blue universe gave room for every star that seemed to vie for attention in this magnificent, vast, endless realm. As she gazed up, it was stunning, massive. The sky stretched out farther than she could see. The expanse was as far left and as far right and as far up as space allowed. Some star shot across in a fraction of a second. She could barely catch a glimpse to turn to see it. It was already gone. She had never seen so many stars. And this was the place to take in that sight. It made her feel like a tiny cog in the great wheel of evolution. The still, frigid air seeped into her bones. She was cold. The Atlantic Siren felt cold. She went inside and wrapped up in the blanket and sipped a mug of hot cocoa Mac had made for her, looking thoroughly drained after her petrifying day of ocean time with Titanic. Her nerves were shot. If the others only knew what was going through her mind, they would not let her venture into Nemo again. She headed to her cabin. Mac was unaware of how traumatic the ordeal had been. As he replayed the footage of her down there, he saw the lights flutter on and off and the full drama of her day's incident on board Nemo. Holy shit. You got to put this in the documentary. You must have shit bricks. This is great, Mac teased. She didn't find it at all funny and paid no attention as Mac insensitively mimicked her reactions to the situation in Nemo. Undeterred, he carried on, mockingly, but she couldn't help but hear. Our worst fears were almost realized, down in the murky depths with the Titanic. The submersible went dark, 2 miles below. We thought we were history, said Mac. Okay, Jade retorted, still unable to laugh. She ignored him and sat down to check out Captain Smith's service record, reading through old articles and White Star records. She read, from 1895 to 1904, Smith was captain of Majestic, a troop carrier to South Africa in the Boer War. His reputation grew after the war. He became the most sought-after captain on the high seas. Many regular passengers would only sail on ships commanded by Edward Smith, making him quite a valuable commodity as far as any shipping line was concerned. Indeed, he became known as the millionaire's captain, as English and American high society members would always choose Smith's ships for their passages, whenever possible. From 1904 onwards, Smith was always the commander of choice for White Star when a captain was required for their latest flagships. He captained the Baltic on her maiden voyage in 1904 and 3 years later the Adriatic. In fact, he had by this time now been promoted to commander and became commodore of the White Star line. At this point, he was the senior most captain of the entire White Star fleet and as such was the highest paid seaman of his day, earning in the region of $600 per month, a colossal sum of money for a lad from any ordinary working class background, in the days when the average working man's wage was only around $25-$30 per month. Smith was captain of Olympic on her maiden voyage and so it was the natural choice for Titanic's maiden voyage too. Smith's career had not always been so auspicious, as people are sometimes misled into believing. There were a number of incidents throughout that blighted his service record. Jade could not believe what she read. Hey, listen to this. January 27, 1889. Commanding the Republic, Smith ran aground off Sandy Hook, killing 3 crewmen and injuring 7 others. She hadn't heard about this. Jade did not pretend to know anything about the sea, nor would she judge a captain's actions, but these were facts that one couldn't deny. Smith had been involved in an accident killing crew. He did not have a clean record? Questions ran through her head. Shit, she whispered. What? Mac questioned, interested. Is this right?
I can't believe it, she turned to him in confidence. Smith was supposed to have a clean record. Chapter 24. Morgan's Yacht, New York, 1911. Morgan's yacht was warm inside, despite the weather in New York where he was moored. You're not going to believe this, said Jack Morgan to his father, holding a telegram they had just received. Olympic's been in an accident on her maiden voyage.
What?
What are you talking about? Asked the old man. You better sit down, said Jack. Arriving in New York Harbor, her propellers drew a tug into her. Let me read it. Jack read the telegram out loud to his now irate father.
To J.P. Morgan from Ismay.
Olympic destroyed tug NY Harbor, stop, suit being. Filed against White Star Line, stop, more detail. Later, stop, regards, stop.
God damn it, Smith.
I don't believe this, Morgan gasped. Morgan's angry voice echoed through to the deck of the yacht. He was not a happy man right now, but when was he? Jack wasn't enjoying the job of being his son. He didn't like the violent eyes staring him down, and the condescending answers and negative countenance his father carried under his gruff skin. It wasn't easy to be around him. He was sour and bitter. He bought off people. He didn't care about them. He only cared about himself and his monetary issues. Jack was noticing it more and more. And he was liking it less and less. Morgan couldn't see farther than his ugly nose. Jack could no longer look into his squinty suspicious eyes. Olympic's maiden voyage. I don't believe it, Morgan huffed. They're taking up a suit against us. What action do we proceed with? Said Jack. They're talking a figure of $50,000. If we fight, we draw attention. We do the smart thing. Pay them off, raged Morgan quietly. He thought a moment. Repair the tug. Keep it as quiet as possible. I don't want my ships to go forth with a bad reputation. They aren't even off the damn dock yet. Chapter 25. Atlantic Siren, 1993. Atlantic Siren was anchored over Titanic as Jade Reed below deck. Mac and Johns were all ears. The next accident the Olympic was in, Jade began, before being cut short by an utterly unbelieving Mac.
Shit.
Next accident?
What the, said Mac.
He came to her side and hovered as he liked to do. She read the long list that condemned Captain Smith and showed he was not the credible captain as had been so told to the public. 1889, Smith ran the Republic aground. 1899 he capsized the Germanic. 1890 he crashed the Coptic. 1909 he crashed the Adriatic. Jade held. This is the guy they let take Titanic? Mac blurted out, incredulously. I couldn't make this up, she offered up to Mac. We always hear he's such a hero.
Don't bring this old shit up around the boss, interjected Flynn.
You don't see something wrong here? She jabbed back. She showed them some footage of pictures of the hull damage. Holy shit. Mac was clearly impressed with the extent of the visible damage to Olympic.
What accident is this? He asked.
This is Olympic's crash with a Hawk, her words came in disbelief. The computer simulation showed clearly how the Olympic's massive propellers drew HMS Hawk in towards her and how her hull was then devastated by her underwater ram. The photos were old 35mm prints that had held up extremely well.
they showed the huge cache, and next to it, standing on the dock, were the men looking rather shocked that Olympic had made it back to the dock at all, shocked that the ram had not put her under. The hole was big enough for a truck to drive through. Exposed and torn open, Olympic's hull lay sprawled, gutted like a giant whale at the mercy of ruthless fishermen. The twisted cold iron and steel said it all, she was through, dead for sure. Fuck's a battleship. It tore the shit out her. Christ, rang Mac. Jane watched the simulated crash. Her heart could not help but relive the moment of the fate of Titanic. The computer program is designed to theoretically figure this kind of accident and recreate the event. Mac got it. So her propeller drew the Hawken and it rammed the shit out of her. Yeah. Slow and pensive, Jade hesitated to believe it. Yeah. That's what it looks like. Just like the tug in New York Harbor. I never heard any of this before. What? Was it the design? Who was it? Andrews, right? He built her? Andrews came on after Carlyle. So did he notice, this propeller, was like a real issue? Mac queried. Someone sure as shit should have noticed. Whatever happened to the Olympic? They declared her a wreck. They made a claim on the insurance. They were turned down. The records show she went back in service for another 25 years. With a hole like that? Mac said in disbelief. Yeah, Jade said softly. But even Mac's face was discerning, resisting the official record. It all raced through his mind. These guys 1 minute say Olympic's a wreck and then it says she does another 25 years? It didn't take much of a discerning eye to see why the ship was declared a wreck. Who writes up this stuff? He thought. The report was tight in her hand as she scrutinized every detail. She was certain that somehow all this would make sense. But it didn't. With the Olympic, it gets so complicated. We can track the history and the construction of the ship and its repair logs up to this point, here. She pointed to the report. Then the records get muddy, she said, as he grabbed the report. There's a big gap in the Harland and Wolf records. Nothing till the records begin again with the war. Olympic sailed on April 8, 1914 with the transport number T2810, transporting British troops to various countries. So why the gap? Mac asked. He wanted another beer, tempted to just close the book on the whole thing. It was too complicated. He looked at Jade, sweet Jade. He thought. Why did she have to dig so much at these kinds of things? Why wasn't she like other women? It immediately dawned on him, that's what drew him to her. This was a passionate, smart, good to be with kind of woman. This was his escape from a life that otherwise might be too dreary, or too academically drab. She made him feel excited. When they were working, it took his mind off the bills he had piled. The weekends that seemed to slip away watching sports, weekends that turned into a life of never getting much done. It was when he was working that he felt alive and excited, and it was working with Jade that gave him the freedom to create. It was as if he was charged up like a battery in her presence. It was something that he couldn't put a name to that was magnetic. He really had never thought about it before. But here on the ship he seemed to notice things he had for so long never questioned, or even realized before. It wasn't an epiphany he was having, but he slipped into thought and though it was but a moment, it seemed such a sense of just being. It was something he had never experienced before. He couldn't reason it, or stop it, nor did he try. It was this ethereal thing that seemed to naturally come upon him. As he watched her work, he began to see her for the first time. He had taken for granted her formidable nature and inner spirit. He was caught up in the moment, just caught up in thought, contemplating. He couldn't help himself. He was not in the past or the future, but just taking it in. Why was he feeling this, thinking this? He wondered why. He tried to shut it out. It was as if he had known her before in some past life. But he didn't believe in that sort of thing. He didn't believe in much of anything. But for just this instant, it was as if time stood still. He was feeling something deeper than sentimental. This wasn't easy. Were the sea and the gentle rock of the ship affecting him? Was it the fresh air or the fantastic presence of the whole adventure? It seemed a long time that these thoughts overwhelmed him, yet he heard her voice and never missed a word she said. Chapter 26. North Atlantic, 1911. On the bridge of Olympic, Captain Smith was preparing for another routine 6 to 7 day trip across the Atlantic, to New York. As he glanced at the chronometer on the bulkhead behind him, it was 12:43 p.m. The weather on the south coast of England was hazy, but not thick enough to warrant trouble. As Olympic was the largest ship in the world, and the novelty attending her departure for a trip across the Atlantic had not yet worn off, a great crowd assembled to witness her departure. Slowly and carefully, the great bulk of Olympic steamed down the channel, past long lines of vessels lying at anchor. Smith was reminiscing this September day, as he stood on the bridge. We have completed 4 return trips to New York. Today she'll embark upon transatlantic voyage number 5 from Southampton Docks. May I have Olympic's passenger list, please? Asked Smith. We're carrying slightly more than 2,000 passengers and around 800 crew members, sir, reported the first officer. Robert A. Taft, son of President Taft, is on passage back to New York, and the prominent Waldorf Astor as well, sir. Thank you, carry on, Smith said as he personally went down to greet the prestigious first class. Good morning. What a pleasure indeed to welcome you aboard the largest and most prestigious ship in the world, RMS Olympic, came Smith. Captain Smith, thank you, replied Taft. We're looking forward to a mild voyage. Seems the weather will be holding, God willing. Yes, but I can assure you of all the other comforts. We are the only ship with a swimming pool heated at 62 degrees, Smith assured. Waldorf Astor, Northern Mariana Islands. Relative of J.J. Astor, came on deck. Mr. Astor. Good morning to you, sir, greeted the captain. Thank you, Captain. Yes, I do look forward to the exquisite accommodations, said Waldorf Astor. They shook hands. This is quite a ship, isn't it, you lucky old dog? Please do join us for drinks and cigars. Shall we say, around 4? In the smoking room, beckoned Waldorf Astor. It would be my pleasure. Although I will be on duty, so I shall only partake in tea and cigars, said Smith. Till then. Keep us well in your hands, will you? Said Waldorf Astor. The pleasure is mine, Captain. He tipped his top hat. Good day, sir, said Smith. Good day, Captain, he said as he left to watch the view from the deck. The captain did his courteous bow and continued to the bridge. After settling their hand luggage in their rooms, the passengers were on deck admiring the beautiful scenery along the waterway out of port. The sound between the Isle of Wight and the mainland of England and south to the Solent was especially breathtaking. There, she headed westward and across the English Channel to Cherbourg. By 12:34 p.m. she had reached the Calshot spit buoy, at which point maneuvers commenced to exit the Thorn Canal and head out into the Solent. George Boyer, the pilot on board, was employed to negotiate the tricky stretches of water, taking Olympic through before reaching the broad, open waters of the English Channel. Southampton Water, with its many hidden sandbanks and narrow channels, is one such difficult and treacherous waterway. No shame in that, especially for ships the size of RMS Olympic, the largest ship in the world. "No shame, Captain," said Boyer. Captain Smith was happy to not have to deal with a trick stretch or Olympic squirks. He was very accepting to have the pilot engaged for the job. Pilots were employed on the basis of their extensive local knowledge of and experience in maneuvering large vessels in difficult and often treacherous waterways. "Just passing the West Bramble buoy to port now, sir," said Boyer to Smith and then to the helmsman. "Turn 2 points starboard, easy, easy does it." Boyer would leave the ship by tender, once they reached the wider expanses of the Solent, the waterway separating England from the Isle of Wight, his brief employ merely guiding ships out into less dangerous waters. As they made the turn to port, Boyer sounded Olympic's whistle twice. "Increase speed from 11 to 16 knots," he immediately ordered. Boyer had been pilot for many of Smith's ships down the years. "Almost there now, Captain Smith," he said. "She'll soon be all yours again, sir." "Thank you for your assistance again, Boyer," Smith replied. "Job well done, my good man." At this time, though, unknown to those on the bridge of Olympic, the British Royal Navy cruiser HMS Hawke had already passed Egypt Point on the northwest tip of the Isle of Wight in what was about 4 miles from Olympic. She was also increasing speed now, having completed the negotiation of another tricky stretch of water, heading for her home port of Portsmouth, home of the British Navy. HMS Hawke was now rapidly reducing the distance between herself and Olympic. Both vessels were attempting to enter the same stretch of water. Commander William Frederick Blunt, master of HMS Hawke, saw it. There was obviously not enough space for both in what was still a narrow channel. "Adjust position by 5 degrees for that liner, on the double," he yelled. But the two ships were by now almost abreast, traveling at 16 knots. Blunt watched the liner swing around towards him. "If she is going east, she won't have room to maneuver. Give her as much room as we possibly can. Turn to starboard." They came fast in the same direction as Olympic. "What the hell? We're being pulled into her," Blunt exclaimed. "Can't they see that? Port engine stop. Starboard engine full astern," he ordered immediately as the grave danger became apparent. The quartermaster at the helm of HMS Hawke was First Class Petty Officer Hunt. "The helm is jammed, sir," he said in alarm. The officer of the watch, Lieutenant Bashford, and leading seaman Yates both sprang to his aid and tried to force the wheel around. They managed to move the wheel about 15 degrees, but the helm did not respond and remained jammed. The rapid, violent motion, first one way then the other, had caused the steering gear to seize up completely. At this point, Olympic tried to accelerate even harder to pull clear of danger, but as Hawke dropped back towards the rear of the liner and the larger vessel eased ahead, the suction of Olympic's massive triple-screw propellers came into play. Blunt's face went white. His stomach cringed for the blow. Hawke was being drawn in so fast Blunt could only watch as the two steel ships were headed towards a sure crash. Closer now, Smith saw he was screwed. It was coming his way, the sharp ram of a battleship. He saw it in his mind before it happened. It would inflict serious damage to Olympic. He knew there was an underwater ram. He saw his career over. He saw the headlines. He saw Morgan's ugly nose staring him down as the dirt was poured over his gravestone and the words etched into his gravestone, "Here lies Smith who crashed my ship." Buck's speed was coming fast and would make the force of the crash a sure nightmare. The passengers had come to the deck and were there, in shock, as they saw the Hawk now within feet of hitting this grand liner. In an instant, Buck's bow embedded itself deep into the superstructure of Olympic with a screeching rip of gashing metal. But she barely made a dent in the massive liner, but its underwater battering ram, designed to cause maximum damage, smashed into Olympic's starboard side. The Hawk's captain knew it had struck an artery. The ram the warship touted inflicted devastating damage below the waterline and laid Olympic open.